eKatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Okay, let's just jump right in. We are diving into a book today, well, more like a whole way of thinking that might just change how you look at everything.
Yeah, it's pretty fundamental.
Seriously.
Yeah.
What if I told you that everything you thought you knew about looking at, say, art in a museum, or even just scrolling through photos online or glancing at ads, what if that was all wrong? Or maybe not wrong, but way more loaded than you realize. What if just seeing is actually political?
That's exactly the punchline of John Berger's Ways of Seeing. It's a landmark work, really.
Right.
And our mission here in this deep dive is to unpack the ideas from the source material, which is a summary of his original 1972 BBC TV series and the book that came with it.
The classic.
Definitely. And Berger's whole point is to expose these hidden assumptions baked into our visual world. He argues that whether it's a fancy old oil painting or a slick modern advertisement, the images we consume are, well, they're often designed to reinforce certain ideas about class, gender, and, you know, capitalism.
So this isn't just stuffy art history. It's about giving you, the listener, some tools, a kind of critical toolkit for visual literacy.
Yeah, to help you see that how you see things is never really a neutral act. It's shaped.
Okay, so who is this guide, John Berger? What makes him the person to lead us through this? He wasn't your typical academic, was he?
No, not at all. And that's key to why his perspective is so powerful.
Yeah.
He had this really interesting blend of backgrounds. First off, he was actually a painter, trained at the Chelsea School of Art.
Ah, okay. So he knew it from the inside, the craft, the technique.
Exactly. He understood how images are made, the choices involved. But then the other crucial part, he was also a committed Marxist social critic.
Right. That combination is pretty unusual.
It really is. And it meant he absolutely refused to separate art from its context. You know, the social world, the economics, the politics surrounding it. For ages, the art world kind of treated paintings like these magical objects, all about genius and beauty, totally separate from everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Berger just cut through that. He insisted you have to ask, who paid for this? Who owned it? What power dynamic is it supporting?
So instead of just focusing on the artist's genius,
yeah,
he's looking at the ideology behind the image.
That's the core shift. His goal was really to democratize how we understand images, to fight back against what he called the mystification of art.
Mystification. Okay, tell us more about that.
Well, this ties into his main point. Seeing isn't objective. It just isn't. He says, and it makes sense when you think about it, the way we see things is affected by what we know or what we believe.
So you never just look. You're always bringing your own baggage, your culture, your assumptions to the table.
Precisely. And mystification is how the traditional art world, according to Berger, sort of keeps control of the meaning.
How does that work? How do they mystify?
Think about the way art critics sometimes talk. Very specialized language, right? Focusing on the artist's spiritual struggle or the transcendent quality of the brushwork.
Yeah, lots of jargon. Sometimes it feels deliberately obscure.
Berger called it a kind of bogus religiosity. And the purpose, he argued, is to distract you from the painting's actual social function.
Which might be.
Often it was about status, property. Think of like a 17th century portrait of a rich merchant family. The critic might talk about the incredible use of light on the silk dress. Berger would say, okay, yes, but let's also talk about the fact that this painting is basically an expensive advertisement for their wealth. Look at the quality of that silk, the imported goods, the land outside the window. It's a record of ownership.
Wow. Okay. So mystification hides the material reality, the power structures, behind a smokescreen of art appreciation.
Exactly. It keeps the interpretation in the hands of the few, the experts, and makes everyone else feel like they just don't get it, which keeps the art valuable and exclusive.
And this whole issue got even more complicated with technology, didn't it? With the invention of the camera.
Oh, massively.
Right.
Because the camera, Berger argues, destroyed what he called the aura of the original artwork.
The aura? What was that?
Before photography, a painting or sculpture was unique. It existed in one specific place, a church, a palace. You had to go to it. It had a kind of presence, a physical authority, maybe even a bit of magic. That's the aura.
Okay, I think I get that. The real thing in its original setting.
Right. But then the camera comes along, and suddenly you can reproduce that image countless times, put it in books, on posters, eventually on screens like we do now.
And that breaks the connection to the original place and time.
Completely. The aura is gone. The image becomes detachable, mobile information. And crucially, its meaning is no longer fixed.
So the same image can mean totally different things depending on where you see it.
Exactly. Think about, say, Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa. In the Louvre, behind bulletproof glass, it has one kind of meaning, priceless masterpiece, cultural icon. But see it on a coffee mug, or in an ad trying to sell you something, or even just as a tiny thumbnail on your phone. The image itself hasn't changed, but its meaning, its authority, is totally transformed by the context. It's been co-opted.
That makes sense. The reproduction strips away that original power, that uniqueness.
Yeah, it becomes something else. Information, maybe. Decoration. A commodity.
And this idea of shifting meanings and images being used for specific purposes leads us straight into one of Berger's most famous and maybe most controversial arguments, doesn't it, about how women are represented.
Yes, this is where he really develops the concept often called the male gaze. And it starts with a really important distinction he makes between nakedness and nudity.
Okay, nakedness versus nudity. They sound like the same thing. What's the difference for Berger?
It's subtle but crucial. Nakedness, he says, is simply being without clothes. It's about being yourself, unadorned. It's a state of being.
Natural, comfortable.
Right. Nudity, on the other hand, is specifically about being put on display for someone else to look at. It's a form of dress, almost. The person is arranged, posed, presented as an object for a spectator.
Ah, so nudity isn't natural. It's constructed. It implies a viewer.
Exactly. It's inherently about being looked at. And this leads him to that incredibly powerful line.
The one everyone quotes.
Yeah. Men act and women appear. Men look at women. Women watch themselves being looked at.
Wow. Let's unpack that. Men act.
Men are the doers, the subjects, the ones with agency in the traditional European visual tradition he's analyzing.
And women appear.
Women are presented primarily as sights, objects to be seen. Their value is often tied to how they look.
Okay. Men look at women.
The viewer, the implied owner of the gaze, is assumed to be male. The art is constructed for his pleasure or assessment.
And the last part is the kicker. Women watch themselves being looked at.
This is the really profound psychological insight. The woman depicted, and by extension, women in a culture saturated with these images, internalize that gaze.
So they start seeing themselves through the eyes of the presumed male spectator.
Yes. They become their own surveyor, constantly monitoring their appearance, turning themselves into an object, judging themselves based on how they think others see them.
That's heavy. And you can see echoes of that everywhere today, can't you? Social media, for instance.
Absolutely. The pressure to present a certain image, the constant self-monitoring. It's like that internalized surveyor working overtime. Berger argued that most European nude paintings weren't really about celebrating the female form in itself. They were about displaying ownership, possession, for the benefit of the male owner or viewer.
It ties back to power again.
Always.
Okay, let's shift slightly. You mentioned ownership and wealth. Berger connects the actual medium of oil paint to the rise of capitalism. That's fascinating. Why oil paint specifically?
Yeah, he saw a really deep connection between European oil painting, particularly from around 1500 to 1900, and the emergence of a capitalist market society that celebrated private property.
How does the paint itself connect to that?
Well, think about what oil paint does really, really well, better than almost any other medium at the time. It renders materiality, texture, sheen, weight, substance.
Okay. Like the way it can capture shiny silk, or the gleam on metal, or the fuzz on a peach.
Precisely. It makes things look incredibly real, tangible, and crucially desirable. It could capture the richness of fabrics, the glint of gold, the plumpness of livestock, the solidity of furniture. It made possessions look valuable.
So the technique itself lends itself to showcasing stuff.
Pretty much. He argues that oil painting became the perfect medium for recording and celebrating what wealthy people owned. The paintings often functioned like visual inventories.
Like a glorified receipt.
In a way, yeah. A portrait wasn't just a likeness. It showed off the expensive clothes, the jewels. A landscape often wasn't just a pretty view. It was this specific person's land, their estate. It visually confirmed their status and ownership.
So the very realism of oil paint served an economic and social function, legitimizing wealth.
That's Berger's argument. It made ownership seem solid, natural, almost eternal.
But surely not all oil paintings were just about showing off possessions. What about artists who seem more interested in, I don't know, human emotion, or spirituality.
He does make exceptions. He points to artists he calls dissidents, like Rembrandt, for example.
Oh, okay.
Artists who use the same medium, oil paint, with all its potential for realism, but turned it towards different ends, exploring things like suffering, old age, vulnerability, inwardness, things that aren't about material wealth.
So they kind of subverted the medium's inherent tendency.
You could say that. They used its ability to depict reality intensely, but focused on psychological or spiritual reality rather than just documenting property.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So we've got mystification, the camera destroying the aura, the male gaze, oil paint, and property. How does this all connect to us right now, living in a world just flooded with images?
Berger argues that the direct descendant, the modern heir, to the tradition of oil painting is advertising, or what he called publicity.
Ah, okay, I can see where this is going.
Modern ads use the exact same visual language, the same symbols of luxury, status, desirability, the same ways of rendering textures to make products look appealing. The compositions, the poses often echo those old master paintings.
The visual toolkit is passed down.
Completely. But there's a key difference in function, he points out.
What's that?
Oil painting, generally, celebrated the wealth and status the owner already had. It confirmed existing property.
Right. Look what I own.
Advertising, however, sells you a future state. It doesn't celebrate what you have. It makes you dissatisfied with it. It promises that buying this product will transform your life, make you happier, more desirable, envied by others.
It sells a promise based on making you feel lacking.
Exactly. It works by manufacturing glamour. And glamour, for Berger, isn't beauty or happiness itself. It's the appearance of happiness, specifically happiness that is envied by others.
So it relies on envy.
Fundamentally. Advertising creates a gap between your current reality and an idealized future self, attainable only through consumption. It makes you envy that future self, and by extension, envy others who seem to already possess that glamour.
That sounds like a pretty cynical view of advertising.
It is critical, for sure. He has this one devastating line about its effect, particularly, he noted, on women's self-perception. He said, advertising steals her love of herself as she is and offers it back to her for the price of the product.
Oof. That's powerful. It steals your self-worth and then sells it back to you piece by piece.
That's the mechanism he identified. The visual language once used to show off a king's power is now used to keep us buying things, fueling the cycle of consumer capitalism by making us constantly feel slightly inadequate.
Okay, this is incredibly clarifying. It connects history right to our phones, our magazines, our streets. So for you listening, now that you have these ideas, these critical tools, what do you do with them? How can we apply this in everyday life?
Well, the most obvious place is when you encounter traditional art, like in a museum. Instead of just passively accepting the masterpiece narrative, the mystification, you can start asking Berger's questions. Who paid for this? Why? What social reality is it reflecting or justifying? Is the person depicted active, or are they just appearing for someone else's gaze?
It turns you from a passive viewer into an active investigator.
Exactly. And then, crucially, apply it to the media you consume every single day, especially advertising and social media. Ask yourself, what feeling is this image trying to evoke in me? What insecurity is it tapping into?
Is it making me feel envious? Is it selling me that glamour?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is it using light and texture, like those old oil paintings, to make this product seem absolutely essential? When you see an influencer's post, are they sharing an experience or are they constructing an appearance designed to be looked at and envied?
It's about decoding the underlying message, the power dynamics embedded in the image.
It really is. The ultimate point, I think, is empowerment. Berger wanted to give people the confidence to trust their own eyes and their own judgment, not just rely on what the experts or the advertisers tell them to see. It's about becoming a critical interpreter, not just a passive receiver of images.
That feels incredibly relevant. Being able to read the visual world critically seems like a basic survival skill now.
I think so. We've seen how Berger just blew up the traditional ways of talking about art, didn't we? Showed that interpreting images is never neutral. It's tied up with power, with defining what's considered real or valuable.
Looking is political. That's the takeaway.
Definitely. He showed us looking is always tangled up with history, economics, and how we relate to each other.
So here's a final thought to leave you with, something that builds on all this.
Mm.
Berger talked about the camera destroying the aura of the unique original through mechanical reproduction.
Mm.
But now, think about today. We're facing the rise of incredibly sophisticated deepfakes, AI-generated images. stuff that looks totally real but has no original physical source. It was never there to begin with.
Right. A whole new level of reproduction, or maybe creation without an original.
So if the aura was lost when the original could be copied, what happens to our idea of visual truth, of seeing is believing, when images can be convincingly fabricated from scratch, completely detached from any material reality? What does authenticity even mean then?
That's a heavy question.
Yeah, something to definitely mull over until our next deep dive.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world.
This audio summary is brought to you by Ecotra Foundation.